Morning, Council. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Please do.
Your Honor, my name is Kendall Moser. I'm a Deputy Attorney General with the State of Hawaii. I represent the appellants in this case, who are the State of Hawaii, the Department of Public Safety, the Halawa Correctional Facility, Dr. Aruzeze, and Dr. Cesar Pederas. I have represented those defendants since the outset of this case. On the court's website, the following passage is found under brief description of this case. The threshold issue in this case is whether the doctrine of qualified immunity extends to a state-employed prison physician who allegedly commits medical malpractice in conjunction with the diagnosis and treatment of an inmate. The answer to that question is yes, because the physicians are government officials who exercise their professional judgment and discretion in their treatment of the plaintiff, Mr. Slingloff.
Counsel, as long as you're diving right in there, now, the Hawaii cases that talk about qualified immunity that are cited in your brief really aren't this kind of case, are they? They're defamation types of cases. Is that true?
For the most part, it is true, but the Marshall versus University of Hawaii case is a case where a professor at the UH Hilo brought suit against various officials at the University of Hilo campus for a number of claims, including defamation. But the part of that opinion that I pointed out to the court is the court's discussion of his NIED, or negligent infliction of emotional distress claim, that he also brought against those officials. So,
right, and that's why I say defamation type, because I did read that and I read the Marshall case. But what I'm trying to get at is this is a different type of case than those cases, in the sense that in those cases, it's, and I'm not going to how the court should decide it, but just the nature of the cases that we already have precedent on in this state, which is somebody said something in the course of what appeared to be a decision-making, official governmental function, as opposed to a doctor treating a patient, or something else that is more in the nature of a run-of-the-mill tort.
Well, it is correct, Your Honor, that there is no published Hawaii appellate court decision that has facts similar to this one.
What about other states?
Yes, Your Honor, I have found those cases. One, though, that we cite in our appellate brief, reply brief, and also this is a case that we cited to Judge Marks, the trial court judge, is the, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Casas versus Gilliam case. Now, Casas is not a doctor, he's a paramedic, but he makes a, if you will, a treatment decision. That is, briefly, the facts of that case were that there was a gunshot victim, an ambulance with paramedics came to pick him up. The paramedic, who's the defendant in the case, Mr. Casas, is told by radio dispatch that the nearest trauma center, which is 7 miles away, already has two trauma victims, and that the farther away trauma center, 12 miles away, apparently does not. So the paramedic makes a decision that taking the plaintiff, well, he's now the decedent, gunshot victim to the nearer facility would not be a good idea because they probably are already overloaded and can't handle another trauma victim. So he makes the decision at that time to take the decedent to the farther facility, and unfortunately the decedent, expires. And there the Texas appellate court found that that it was a discretionary action on behalf of the paramedic which required personal deliberation, decision, and judgment, and not a ministerial act.
But the rationale for the qualified immunity goes to government employees performing governmental functions, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
This is a doctor. He's performing professional responsibility as a doctor. Why, given the rationale for qualified immunity, should we extend qualified immunity that's directed at protecting employees performing government functions to a doctor?
Well, Your Honor, the doctors in this case, Drs. Aruzeze and Dr. Pederas, are government employees working in a government facility and treating patients whom they don't have a decision whether to treat or not. These people, including Mr. Selingoff, were committed to the care by the courts of the director of the Department of Public Safety. So these government doctors don't get to choose who they treat, and they treat the inmates with the confines that any government official operates under.
But doesn't
policy
that
decisions, budget decisions, and so forth.
Excuse me.
I'm sorry.
No, I shouldn't interrupt. But doesn't that really go to whether the doctor is negligent? Because if it's beyond his control, then he wouldn't fall below his duty, you know, his standard of care, as opposed to whether he is immune from suit.
Well, the doctor makes decisions, medical treatment decisions, in a governmental setting with governmental limitations. So it's.
But doesn't that, don't those limitations set the standard of care?
In other words, shouldn't we analyze whether he was negligent vis-a-vis a prison doctor?
Well,
which is different than whether he gets qualified immunity.
I believe, Your Honor, that regardless whether a patient is within the correctional system, a medical patient, or without it, the doctor is going to apply the same, the community standard is going to apply whether he treats within the correctional facility or out. It's just that when we're talking about a doctor employed in a governmental correctional facility like we have in this case, there are additional considerations that a doctor in private practice would not have. And some of those additional considerations are referred to in additional authorities, which I have found and would like to.
So you think that's what makes it a governmental function?
Yes.
Would that cover other governmental health care providers, say, if we all had governmental health care?
Well, there is, and I know it's off limits to talk about unpublished decisions, but I am aware of an unpublished decision from one of Hawaii's appellate courts, which talks about immunity in the context of a paramedical assistant working at Leahy Hospital near Diamond Head. So I think it applies not only then to a doctor, but to other health care.
Now, in this case, you're not appealing the court's finding of negligence, correct?
No, Your Honor. We had our day in court, and we lost.
Now, is there a distinction between qualified immunity and sovereign immunity? In other words, even if the individual doctors are qualifiedly immune from suit, would the state still be liable under a theory of negligence?
Yes, Your Honor. Under the State Tort Liability Act, Chapter 662 of the HRS, the state, of course, has respondeat superior liability for its employees. So even though a state employee has, or even when a state employee has qualified immunity, he or she does not have personal liability, but his or her employer, the state, would still have liability. And that's a decision that was made when the State Tort Liability Act was enacted some time ago.
So your argument today is not that the state should remain on the judgment, only that the doctor should be taken off.
That is correct, Your Honor. And if the doctors are taken off the judgment, as Your Honor has said, that will not affect, that reason by itself would not affect the plaintiff, Mr. Selingoff's recovery. The judgment in this case is against all of the defendants, appellants, the state, PSD, the correctional facility.
So by the same reasoning, you're also not contending that the doctor was engaged in discretionary function then?
Your Honor, I am arguing, the state is arguing that the doctor exercised his professional judgment and opinion making and his...
In a non-discretionary way for purposes of the sovereign immunity waiver.
Right, Your Honor. Yes. If I may just go back to talking briefly about the Casas versus Gilliam case. The court there, the Texas appellate court, said that because discretionary actions are those which require personal deliberation, decision, and judgment, while ministerial actions require obedience to orders or performance of a duty as to which the actors left no choice, Casas's actions were inherently discretionary. Again, this is the paramedic who's making the decision whether to take the gunshot victim.
Do you have the cite to that handy?
Yes, Your Honor, I do.
Yeah.
It is, Your Honor, 869 Southwest 2nd, and I will pick the page. 671.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Your Honor. However, in response to the court's indication on its website of what the threshold issue in this case, that caused me, of course, to dig a little deeper. The reply brief that we filed and the reply brief that we filed at the trial court level was a response to the plaintiff's argument that, well, qualified immunity doesn't apply in this case because the claims against the doctors here are for negligence, and the Hawaii cases talk about something other than negligence. When I saw, however, what the court wanted apparently to speak about today, as I said, I found a couple of Supreme Court decisions from two other jurisdictions, one from the state of Utah, the Supreme Court of the state of Utah. That is a case called Ross versus Shackle, 920 Pacific 2nd, 1159. That's a 1996 case, again from the Utah Supreme Court. And then Sparks versus Kim, 701 Southern 2nd, 1113, Mississippi Supreme Court, 1997. Both of these cases are, I would say, very similar to this case.
The Sparks decision goes the other way, then, right? I mean, in Mississippi, well, actually, no, I suppose you, Sparks decision did hold qualified immunity, but they went beyond and they said, well, because these are prison doctors, because of the unique situation of treating prisoners and prisoners being litigious, are you suggesting that we adopt the majority's position in Sparks in Hawaii?
I am suggesting that the court, after I bring to the court's attention those two cases and cases cited therein, the mm-hmm. Ross case, the Utah case, refers
right.
to decisions from three other jurisdictions, Alabama, Oregon, and Michigan. I think that those cases are factually the most similar cases that are out there and hit right on this issue of whether a prison doctor has qualified immunity. And what we see in the Hawaii, if I can just back up for a moment, what we see in the Hawaii appellate court decisions is that the court continually refers to whether the government official has discretion. In Reynolds versus Okamoto, the Supreme Court found that the city auditor possessed a wide range of discretion in carrying out the functions of her office. In Lane versus Yamamoto, which was a case involving the city prosecutor, this court, the ICA, found that the prosecutor can be liable for damages if it is found that in exercising his discretion, he was motivated by malice. Again, Kajia, which is cited in our decision, our opinion, excuse me, in our brief. This court, again, the ICA, held that the director could be held liable if he maliciously exercised his official discretion. Now, if there's a concern that, well, qualified immunity, though, applies to directors and lieutenant governors and prosecutors and high ups and so forth, I think those concerns could be laid to rest by a quote in the Taos versus State decision in which the Supreme Court cited Barr versus Mateo, a U.S. Supreme Court decision. They said, it is not the title of his office, but the duties with which the particular officer sought to be made to respond in damages is entrusted, the relation of the act complained of to matters committed by law to his control or supervision, which must provide the guide in delineating the scope of the rule which clothes the official acts of the officer with immunity. Again, the doctors certainly exercise their discretion and judgment. But if I might.
So your position is that every state employed doctor gets qualified immunity?
No, not necessarily. I believe it depends what the doctor was doing. If the doctor was performing a discretionary act, one in which he or she was using their discretion, judgment, experience, and so forth, then they certainly have qualified immunity. If their actions were more in the nature of a ministerial act, I don't know. I think what we have.
No, but you're saying every doctor, by virtue of being employed by the state, is eligible for qualified immunity.
If the conditions are right, yes. That is what I am saying. Yeah.
If the judgment stands, does the state provide an indemnification of Dr. Abrizi and Dr. Pederis?
Assuming the legislature approves the Attorney General's request, then yes. And that happens with the exception of what happened to the in the 2011 legislature, in every instance that any of us with our collective institutional knowledge can recall. So the short answer is yes, Your Honor, they would be. Well, the state would pay the judgment. If I could talk about Ross just briefly, this is a case in which an inmate at the Utah State Prison sued the prison doctor, a government employee, for medical malpractice. As it turned out, the inmate had a very bad leg break, but the doctor thought that it was a cartilage and ligament damage. He failed to treat the fracture, and he ignored the prisoner's repeated complaints of severe pain. Thereafter, the inmate's leg healed improperly. He was taken to the University of Utah Medical Center, and they had to perform surgery to re-break his leg and then set it properly with pins and metal rods. In its discussion of immunity, the Utah Supreme Court said, "We can identify the applicable rule at common law. A prison doctor, if performing a ministerial duty in good faith, would have been liable for compensatory damages but not for punitive damages. However, the doctor would have been immune for an action for negligence if acting in a discretionary, official capacity." And then they apply the facts to the law and conclude as follows. Shackle's rendering of medical care to prisoners could not properly be described as ministerial in nature at common law. The care a prison physician provides does not merely involve the execution of a set task without the need for judgment and discretion. Nor does the case arise out of a clear set of facts. Rather, a great deal of judgment and opinion are involved in making a diagnosis and prescribing appropriate medical treatment. In response to the Chief Judge's question, you know, we had our day in court, we had a trial, and we lost. But I think what we were able to show was, in Mr. Slingloff's case, this was a very unusual situation. It was a rare kind of infection. It was fast-moving and difficult to diagnose. I say that as an aside here, as we look at what the Shackle facts were. And then, in conclusion, the Utah Supreme Court said a number of cases from other jurisdictions hold that medical care is discretionary in nature, entitling the physician to immunity. And then the court goes on, as I said, to cite cases from Alabama, Michigan, and Oregon.
But Mr. Moser,
yes, sir.
Just assuming for the moment that we've read Ross, aren't there also states and jurisdictions that have gone the other way, like Kentucky, Missouri, a few others maybe?
I did not find those cases, Shara, and it's not that I didn't look for them. I want to, as best I can, represent to the court my understanding of what the law is in other jurisdictions, because we don't have something like that in this right. jurisdiction. So I did not find those cases. I'm not in any way doubting that they might exist, but I did not find them.
Going back to the rationale for qualified immunity, which is the fear that you're going to deter a government official from acting, for exercising its official function.
Yes.
Doctors already face medical malpractice. Generally, doctors already, they're professionals. They face the potential liability for medical malpractice. Why would imposing a medical malpractice negligence liability upon a prison doctor, why would that cause that doctor to hesitate to act or to fit into the whole rationale for qualified immunity?
I think that could be answered, John, by a passage in one of the decisions that I read that I suspect that being an MD, a doctor, going through that rigorous training process and all that comes along with it, probably working at a prison would not be everyone's dream job while they're in medical school or thinking about medical school. We're not going to be able to get every kind of doctor out there who will voluntarily come and work as a doctor in this kind of setting.
That's a different issue, right? In other words, whether you can attract someone to the position versus whether you affect their decision-making in terms of their diagnosis. Explain to me why you need qualified immunity to affect a doctor's diagnosing a patient in terms of the patient's medical condition. Why does absolute liability figure into that calculus?
Well,
qualified immunity, I'm sorry.
Right, Your Honor. That question might be answered by, again, a passage from one of the cases that I found. This is the Sparks case, the Mississippi case. The court said there that doctors working in state hospitals are not able to view their inmate patients as mere medical patients, but they must also view them as security risks whose treatment also involves considerations unrelated to medical necessities. The medical needs of prisoners must inevitably be weighed in the context of concerns involving security, the sound and orderly administration of the prison, and the funding for said services provided by the government. Inmate patients are a different kind of medical patient I've seen over the years, and there are, again, these additional considerations that the court found in the Mississippi case, which I believe apply equally to our doctors here in Hawaii, Dr. Spadaris and Dr. Abruzzese.
Counsel, but yes, I'm thinking that those concerns can be worked into the matrix of either negligence, whether the doctor performed under a particular standard of care, and or whether the government should take responsibility for the conditions under which they ask their employees to work. What I'm also trying to get at is, why does official immunity or qualified immunity need to be employed under these circumstances, where the underlying rationale for that immunity is more to do with broad governmental policy application? I'm having trouble fitting the doctor's actions under that construct.
Well, the state, under the State Tort Liability Act, is responsible for the doctor's negligence. And the state will pay this judgment for the doctor's, what was found to be a breach of the standard of care. But it doesn't benefit the plaintiff in any way to have the doctors personally responsible. The plaintiff will receive his payment of his judgment, assuming nothing else changes in this case. So it's not going to affect the interests of justice for the plaintiff.
But your analysis is sort of, although the doctor was not performing a discretionary function for purposes of sovereign immunity, the sovereign immunity exemption, you're arguing he was performing a discretionary function for purposes of the qualified immunity.
He was exercising his discretion and not performing.
What's the difference between the two? I mean, how do we analytically say that? In other words, how do we say, if we rule in your favor, we're going to have to say, okay, well, it doesn't get, there's no sovereign immunity because it's not engaged in a discretionary function for sovereign immunity law, but because he was involved in discretionary function, he's got qualified immunity.
Well, what I'm trying to say, and I guess I'm not doing a good enough job of it, is that the doctor was not performing a ministerial function. He didn't have a set task, and you must do it this way, and this is how you do it. As a doctor employed by the government, he is given discretion as to how to render his care and treatment.
But that's different from the discretionary function immunity, discretionary function exemption for the state under the sovereign immunity.
Under the State Tort Liability Act.
Right.
So, Your Honor, I think going back and looking at the cases that I've both cited in our briefs and the additional cases which I've brought up this morning, going back then to the threshold, what the court has termed the threshold issue in this case, that is, whether qualified immunity applies to these state doctors, I believe that the answer is unquestionably yes. And therefore, the doctors respectfully request that this court vacate the final judgment entered against them and instead enter judgment in their favor. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Chief Judge Nakamura and Judges Fujise and Leonard and Mr. Mosier, and I do want to mention that my client, Gregory Allen Slingloff, is also present in the courtroom, sitting in the back. I'll start off by saying that what Mr. Mosier, what the state is really trying to do here is undo the undo the State Tort Liability Act by giving prison doctors total immunity, really total immunity, not qualified immunity. And of course, where do you go next? Where do you go next with that argument? We like to think about analogies as lawyers and judges, and I think about deputy attorney generals deciding on their own to get in their car and take some paperwork someplace else, take some legal state paperwork someplace else, and then getting into an accident. Well, does that fall under discretionary function because the deputy attorney general decided to drive the paperwork himself and not give it to a messenger? How far do you take this expansion of the immunity doctrine?
Well, but Mr. Turbin, Mr. Moser just said the state is liable under the State Tort Liability Act. The state has made an admission, and since they didn't appeal, I assume that that's an authorized admission. Doesn't that sort of counter what you're saying? He says your client has an effective remedy. He's going to get paid. Why do we need to go after the doctors?
Well, it's nice. I mean, it's a relief to hear Mr. Moser say that. But to borrow a phrase, can we really take that to the bank? What if there's another administrator? I mean, I'm not sure whether the Attorney General himself is saying that.
It's a discretionary function.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like they're going to discretionarily decide whether they're going to pay this judgment or not. And I think it's really a matter of law. When he started talking about that, I was thinking that this is something he should have brought up before we went to trial. There's a myriad of cases, medical malpractice cases, where lawyers for hospitals or lawyers for medical plans, for medical facilities say, hey, my clients have agreed that we're going to indemnify the doctors if we prevail on this case or if we settle the case. Would you please, dismiss the cases against the individual doctors or the individual nurses? And we often do that, as a courtesy. But this is something done prior to the litigation, not after the litigation.
Well, what about the prison context? There are other jurisdictions that have focused on the fact that it's a prison setting, so it's not equivalent to a civilian doctor being able to treat a patient. There are limitations given the security concerns of prison. Does that, in the limited context of a prison doctor, does that affect the analysis in terms of whether qualified immunity should be granted to prison doctors?
Well, I haven't had the benefit of looking at, these cases, State Ross v. Shackle and Sparks versus Kim. I know, Judge Leonard, you've certainly looked at least the Sparks v. Kim case, but, as a habit, I look at cases, I brief cases that opposing counsel cite in their brief, so I can't talk about those cases. But my understanding is that the overwhelming majority of legal opinion, is that, prison doctors have to follow community standards, and that's what Mr. Moser said during his oral presentation.
Well, recognizing that's what Mr. Moser said, I do have some concerns of that, frankly, counsel. I mean, if a doctor can't go in and treat prisoners on Saturday or Sunday, I'm not saying that was the case here because it's not in the record, but wouldn't he or she be held to a different standard if those were the work conditions? I mean, wouldn't that change the standard that the doctor's held to?
Well, I don't want to...
They're admitting liability.
Right. I don't want to retry the case, but there are prison regulations that require basically that prisoners get the same level of medical care that anybody else does.
Conceptually, if there weren't such regulations, and the doctor had to practice medicine with one hand tied behind his back, then he'd be held to, he or she would be held to a different standard of care.
Yeah, I mean, if a doctor was had to practice medicine with one hand tied behind his back, I mean, that does that's not the case okay. here. I mean, I could, you know, mention what.
But
you
if
know,
there
what,
were some official constraints in the context of the particular employment, that might affect the standard.
Yeah, if there were specific constraints. Well, I think, you know, the doctor could lose his or her license for not practicing good, you know, for not practicing
within
the standard of care.
Well, let me give an example. Well, one of the findings was that you didn't see the patient in a reasonable period of time. But it certainly, prison, I would assume that prison is not the same situation where a doctor can just say, can just walk up and say, I want to go see prisoner so-and-so. There's got to be some things or some hoops that have to be jumped through before a doctor would be able to see a prisoner as a patient, which would be different from well, somebody not in prison.
Right. In this particular case, Your Honor, what Dr. Padera should have done is either, you know, gone to the prison to see the patient or really instructed the nurse, get him over to an emergency room. Because when you have, I mean, I'm getting into the medical facts of the case, but when you have a swollen scrotum, it's a potentially life-threatening disease. The most common disease is what's called testicular torsion, which is the twisting of the testicle, which can cause gangrene rather rapidly. And what he should have done, and of course it came out in evidence, is he should have told the nurse, send Mr. Slingloff to the emergency room to have an emergency room doctor determine whether he has testicular torsion. That's what he should have done.
But you're conceding that a prison doctor is operating under a different environment than a non-prison doctor.
I don't believe.
In general terms.
No, I'm not going to concede.
You don't think there's any difference between the two in terms of what they can do in treating a patient?
Well, they have an infirmary, and in certain respects, prison doctors have it better off because they have an infirmary within walking distance. So security is not an issue. He can just simply say, which he should have done in this case, get Mr. Slingloff over to the infirmary and let me really check him out. If it was on a Monday, if it's Saturday or Sunday, get Mr. Slingloff to an emergency room and check out whether he has testicular torsion, which could kill him by Monday morning if he had it. So I don't think the prison doctors, I mean, I know we're talking hypothetically. Maybe some prisons, maybe there's some prisons out there, you know, in the middle of Alaska, you know, in the north range of Alaska, where a prison doctor has it really tough. But actually, in our setting here, that infirmary is always staffed. It's very close by. Get them to the infirmary, and then which he should have done, and should have drained the infection. You know, find out whether he has testicular torsion. He didn't drain the infection. From all the evidence I saw in this case, Padera's was not acting at a handicap here.
Mr. Turbin, I think what we're kind of asking you about is beyond the specific facts of the negligence here, which the state has not conceded or has not challenged on appeal, because you know we have to write this down and presumably someone will read it and quote us on it someday. So we're just trying to get clarity on the general standard, not so much the facts of this case.
Yeah, it's general community standards. I mean, everything I have read, I mean, of course, I didn't read the, you know, Shackle case or the Kim case, but prison doctors operate under the same standards, same community standards that all other doctors operate under. And that's in the regulations. That's in the state prison regulations also. So I'm going to stick to that position, if you don't mind. I guess if there's can I move on? Yeah. I'm really interested in what qualified – well, first of all, I do want to talk about that this case that was Cassis versus Gillian, which is an interesting case. And I think first of all, we don't have the advantage of the Texas statute. So we don't know how the Texas statute relates to 662-2. But when I read the decision, it's a relatively short decision, one thing that struck me was that Cassis, the paramedic in this situation, was obligated to follow the Texas health code, the Texas health law, pertaining to taking an injured victim to a hospital. And the Texas health code, it's in the statute, it's in the case, says that the paramedic must take the victim to the nearest open emergency room. And in this situation, Cassis, the paramedic, determined that the nearest open emergency room was the one he took him to. It's a few miles past the nearest one. He calculated that emergency room as being closed because it was so busy, it would have been a long period of time before they would have been able to see the victim. So under the statute, he complied with the statute to take the victim to the closest open emergency room. Now that is analogous to our 662.15.1, which sets out the discretionary function exception, because that statute that says any claim based upon an act or omission of an employee of the state exercising due care in the execution of a statute or regulation, you know, whether or not such statute or regulation is valid, that's a discretionary function. So what happened in this situation is Cassis was complying with the applicable state regulation take him to the nearest open emergency room, which is, you know, similar to the police, you know, police brutality cases, in essence, where if a police officer is acting in the course of his assignment to be a police officer to preserve the peace, so long as he doesn't violate the constitutional right of the defendant, and so long as he has, you know, a reasonable imminent fear of harm, he can act as he does. I mean, that's our Ogden case, Hawaii's Ogden case, and Clark, and several out-of-state cases that Mr. Mosier cites, Clark v. Dunn, and others. But I thought what's really interesting is when our appellate court and our Supreme Court, for example, in Rogers versus State, in Breed versus Shaner, when the U.S. Supreme Court talks about qualified immunity under the Dale Light case, it talks about the purpose of qualified immunity, the discretionary function exception, meaning that the courts in a negligence case should not interfere with the work of our legislature, our work of our executive. It's a separation of powers issue whereby our courts, our negligent cases, should not interfere with the broad, important policy decisions made by our executive and our legislature. And of course, I know you're familiar, they talk about what the broad policy decisions are.
Well, why do you think the decision in this case did not fall into that category?
Well, because it's not a major governmental policy decision whether to prescribe an antibiotic to a prisoner who's suffering from an infection. That's obviously an everyday, routine, operational level act. And that's the phrase that's used by our courts, whether or not it's an everyday, routine, operational level act. And I can't see what is more a routine, everyday, operational level act than deciding whether to prescribe an antibiotic to a sick prisoner like Gregory Slingloff. It's not a broad policy decision, and the courts talk about such as deciding whether or not to build a prison, deciding whether or not to build an airport, whether or not to buy a certain type of airplane. The broad policy decisions are those which where the executive or the legislative body has to weigh important, as they call, financial, political, and economic calculations. They have to weigh those issues. Our, I guess, Rothschild, I think it's a Rothschild case, you know, talks about that, where the government, for policy reasons, political, economic reasons, decided not to rebuild the bridge, really, the Moanalua Bridge going over Moanalua Stream. I mean, that's a broad policy decision, would cost countless millions of dollars to do that. That's obviously a discretionary function of the government. If I can just talk a little bit about the issue of fertility, which was brought up in Mr. Mosier's brief. I would like to touch upon that. I think the state is just very wrong when it says that the circuit court's decision that Mr. Slinglaw suffered loss of fertility, that it was a clearly erroneous decision by the circuit court, is just cannot be maintained when you look at the evidence presented.
Well, was there any evidence that he was fertile prior to this incident? I guess that seems to be the state's argument, that absent that evidence, then that there's speculative. It's not sufficient.
Yeah, there certainly was, and I really the state. I took umbrage to the state implying that Mr. Slinglaw was not being honest to Dr. Schmidt, because, you know, what he told Dr. Schmidt, according to the record, is that he never fathered a child, which is true. He never did father a child, but on one occasion, he is absolutely certain that he impregnated his high school girlfriend while in high school, and then they decided that she would abort the child. So he did not become a father in this case. And he said there was one other instance where he believed he impregnated a girlfriend later. He wasn't absolutely sure, but they thought he had, and that girlfriend.
So that evidence answers the question of whether there was any evidence of that your client was fertile prior to this incident.
Right. But I want to make it clear that Mr. Slinglaw did not lie to Dr. Schmidt as imputed by the state. But what was, I thought, so conclusive in our case was not only Dr. Joseph Schmidt, our urologist, opined that Mr. Slingloff's fertility was ruined by the state's medical malpractice, but even the state's own expert urologist, Dr. Herbert Chin, he stated on the record that he also believed Dr. Chin testified, it would seem overall that this infection played a significant role in Mr. Slinglaw's infertility. That's a transcript, page 123 and 124. And Dr. Schmidt also was very clear on the mechanism of how Gregory became infertile because of the state's malpractice. He stated three medical reasons. One, that the massive infection required multiple surgical procedures and removal of dead tissue and the placement of skin grafts and repositioning of his testes, that most likely would cause infertility. Second, he also had epididymitis, and that's inflammation of the gland that stores the sperm right next to the testes, and the epididymitis occurred on both sides, so that would also cause infertility. And three, that all the multiple surgeries that he had would run the risk of impairing blood flow to the testes. So three mechanical reasons why what happened to Mr. Slinglaw would cause infertility. I think there's, you know, I would argue that there's no other, ruling to make other than that the circuit court judge was not clearly erroneous when she came to the conclusion that this unfortunate occurrence caused Mr. Slimloff's infertility. So in my remaining time, would the court like me to discuss, you know, some of the cases that were discussed in the briefs? In our answering brief, Mr. Mosher just really cited the two cases, Taos and the Medeiros versus Kondo. Taos is a case I'm quite familiar with because I represented the prisoners in that case some 29 years ago. I can't believe how much time has passed. It seems like yesterday. But that case, in that case, the court, not surprisingly, found the qualified immunity because the causes of action that I set out in that case, defamation and false imprisonment, are clearly exempted by 662.15.4, where, you know, that 662.15.4, of course, says any claim arising out of assault, battery, false imprisonment, false arrest, malicious prosecution, abuse of process, libel, slander, misrepresentation, deceit, or interference with contract rights are exempted, and you have to prove malice in that case. And the court ruled that we were not able to prove malice as far as the actions taken by Lieutenant Governor, I think it was Lieutenant Governor Doy, the Attorney General at the time, the Director of Corrections, that just decided that they had to revamp the prison, and they essentially let 60 prisoners.
So your argument is, or your theory is that qualified immunity is effectively coextensive with the exemptions for sovereign immunity.
That's right. That's right. Because the case law does say that with those exemptions, you have to prove malice. And I also want to mention that Marshall case, if I can, the Marshall case, which Mr. Mosher discussed in his presentation. The Marshall case, and I think Judge Leonard rightly pointed out, that was a really a case that derived out of defamation, really out of defamation, which is an exemption under 662.15.4, but also that case arose out of a breach of a contract right, because Marshall was contended that he had the right to have tenure granted to him, which was a contract right, but the tenure was being postponed because of the investigation of sex harassment. So the negligent infliction of emotional distress really was totally derivative to the breach of contract claim and the defamation claim, which is exempted under 662.15.4. But, you know, simple negligence, simple torts, you know, medical malpractice is not exempted under 662.15.4. It's obviously the type of case that our state legislature in 1957 decided would be permissible. Those torts would be permissible under the State Tort Liability Act. And the legislative intent is clear that state employees in the ordinary tort case will be treated just as a private person is treated in a normal tort case, except you don't get prejudgment interest and you don't have punitive damages, and in most instances you have a judge trial rather than a jury trial.
So the doctors in this case would not have been subject to punitive damages in any instance.
Yeah, I don't believe
so. Actual even if there's actual
malice. I mean, yeah. Yeah, I don't believe that. I don't think we can get punitive damages. We wouldn't be able to get punitive damages or prejudgment interest.
Yeah. That's pretty.
So then the other Hawaii cases are pretty clear. I mean, my argument would be that if the defense, if the state prevails in this case, it would be a huge upheaval regarding the State Tort Liability Act. I mean, it would essentially undo it. We would be going down a slippery path, and net following doctors would be almost every other. The logic would be utilized for almost every other run-of-the-mill case, because you can always say in some ways a state employee's discretion in what they do is different from everybody else's, when really it isn't. But, if we go the Upchurch versus State case is really a seminal case, and that's an important case where it states that the way a prison guard was working as far as supposedly attempting to enable a prisoner to be secure, that was not a discretionary function. That was an operational level action. Breed v. Shaner is a very interesting case, which talks about negligent highway design and repair, and that's an operational. That's an operational level action, not a discretionary function. And, the court in that case was very interesting, saying if the court makes a decision to build a highway, that's a discretionary function. But thereafter, when decisions have to be made about keeping it safe and maintaining it properly, that's an operational level act. Rogers versus State, interesting case, and there the court stated that improper placement of highway road signs and striping, that's an operational level act, not a discretionary function. Nakahira versus State, interesting case where the court said, well, the decision to allow the new regulation allowing non-aviators to do ordinary maintenance of helicopters, that's a discretionary action. But in Nakahira, the issue was that the state did not properly train those non-aviation maintenance people, and that's an operational level act, not a discretionary function. And then the more recent case of, Taylor Rice versus State, very interesting case where a kind of buried guardrail caused a fatal accident. And the court said that's an operational level act. They were repairing, they were spending $1.3 million to repair that highway anyway. It would have been another $11,000 to redo the guardrails and make the guardrails safe. They had made it more dangerous by adding another lane, putting this lane closer to the guardrails. And that spending the $11,000 to do proper guardrail repair was an operational level act, not a discretionary function. And and Rogers versus State, our Supreme Court stated, quote, in a strict sense, every action of a government employee involves the use of some degree of discretion. And that's what Mr. Mosier's argument is. Every act describes some degree of discretion, but it doesn't put it in the discretionary function exception if we're not talking about broad policy decisions. As when I started out, if a deputy attorney general decides to take a car to deliver a document and gets into an accident, that's a discretionary action. Decided to make the right turn or run through the yellow light, that's a discretionary action. You can't take those everyday routine decisions that we all make every day of our life and say all of them puts it into the discretionary function exception. So I see there's no more questions, but I just wanted to
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I do have one more question. I just want to confirm, sort of for record keeping, You agree Nurse Mike and Nurse Barber were never served, and there's no substitution for Dr. Patel, so they should not.
Well, yeah, I do want to say, though, that thinking about it, I mean, first of all,
let me just start. Were Nurse Mike and Nurse Barber served?
No, they weren't served. Okay. But I would say that under rule of run under 12H, the state waived that defense by not bringing it up at time of trial. So they do not have to be dismissed out because they were.
But you can't get a judgment against them individually, can you?
Probably not. Probably not. I think when the time is right, I guess, you know, certainly Mr. Mosier was kind enough to say that, you know, the state will pay the judgment. We certainly, you know, can, you know, we'll certainly release them out when it goes back to circuit court. But I think we have to stipulate that. I guess we have to sign the stipulation papers in circuit court. We'd have to go back to circuit court before we can do the mechanical work.
And was there a substitution for Dr. Patel in this case? He passed away.
I don't believe so. I don't recall substituting.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Your Honors, I've reserved for myself 5 minutes, so I will talk fast. First of all, Mr. Turbin said that there would not be an opportunity to have punitive damages awarded against them. While it's true that under the State Tort Liability Act, one cannot get punitive damages against the state, certainly one can get punitive damages against a state employee, a man or a woman, under the right circumstances. And I refreshed my recollection by looking at a copy of the complaint. One of the requested reliefs is for punitive damages. Mr. Turbin would certainly know that punitive damages could not have been awarded against any of the other defendants besides the doctors, the individuals. Mr. Turbin said that what the state really is arguing for is total immunity versus as opposed to qualified immunity. That is not correct. We're not arguing for total immunity for the doctors, but rather qualified immunity. And we all know the standard for when we're trying to prove whether there was malice or not. First, it has to be alleged, and second, it has to be proved by clear and convincing evidence. There's no allegation of malice in the complaint.
What would your test be for malice be? Because in the defamation cases, they have a relatively low standard, reasonable person standard. Would that be the standard that we would apply for the qualified immunity?
For qualified immunity.
Right.
Well,
for qualified immunity for a doctor for medical malpractice versus defamation.
Well, yes, I believe that would be the right standard, Your Honor.
Now, in Awakuni versus Awana, don't they say motivated by ill will or intent to commit or reckless disregard of committing a wrongful act? Isn't that the standard the Supreme Court adopted?
For malice, right. When the plaintiff has to prove malice, he has to show willfulness, intention.
None of the defamation cases, though. The defamation cases says objective man standard.
Well, I believe in a defamation case, defamation being an intentional tort, as opposed to the negligence that's alleged in this case, two different situations.
Okay, so your view of malice for purposes of your qualified immunity test would be a fairly high standard.
Well, in this case, that yes, they would have to show that the doctors were malicious, reckless, acted willfully or intentionally. One of the findings I should point out that Judge Marks made was
acted intentionally to harm the patient.
Right, and she found that in this case that the doctors did not intentionally ignore or maliciously ignore the plaintiff. They did treat him. It wasn't to his satisfaction, obviously. That's why we're here today, and. But anyway, they didn't maliciously ignore him. Was one of the findings that the trial judge made. And as I said, not only was malice not alleged, it was not proved. There were uncontested affidavits that the doctors submitted at the time of the motion for summary judgment. I would remind everyone also that originally in the complaint there were allegations of a violation of 42, well, I guess the Eighth Amendment through 42 U.S.C. Section 1983. I believe that's why the doctors were named, because if the plaintiff were to prove that the doctors violated his constitutional rights, then there that would affect the recovery, or it would affect the amount of the judgment in the sense that the plaintiff could get all of his reasonable attorney's fees and costs. Mr. Turbin argued that said that he didn't want to argue the facts of the case, but then almost immediately launched into a discussion of the facts of the case. And specifically, he said that the Dr. Pederis should have gotten the plaintiff to the infirmary right away, and he talked for some time about that. I think what that really shows is that Dr. Pederis exercised his medical judgment. He prescribed an antibiotic. He kept the plaintiff for a time in part of the facility that he thought was appropriate. With regard to the Casas case that we've been talking about against the gunshot victim and the paramedic, I believe respectfully that Mr. Turbin might have misrepresented a key issue in that case. The court said that the issue we must address is not whether Brooke Army Medical Center was closed, but whether Casas made his decision to drive to the more distant trauma center based upon a good faith inquiry as to which facility could best treat the decedent. And the paramedic made the determination based on his, as the court says immediately beforehand, 15 years of experience, that the more distant facility was the closest appropriate hospital. Dr. Pederis and Dr. Abuzizi prescribed the antibiotic that they thought was appropriate under the situation. I do want to say just real briefly that with regard to this issue of fertility, the impregnation versus fatherhood, we were not attempting to impugn Mr. Slingluff's honesty, but rather I was pointing out an inconsistency in what he represented to plaintiff's expert and to at trial. So, Your Honor, in closing, I guess I would say to sum up that there's probably no government official who exercises more judgment and discretion than a physician who makes treatment decisions for his patient. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Take the case under submission.